Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, the unscripted show that celebrates unsung heroes, myth busts historical lies, and rediscovers the forgotten stories that changed our world. I'm your host, Scott Rank. Before Alexander Hamilton was a Broadway sensation, about the only fact people knew about him was that he had a nemesis, and most people would name him as Aaron Burr. But if you were to ask Alexander Hamilton who his true nemesis was, he would give a different name, and that is Albert Gallatin. Gallatin was Treasury Secretary for 12 years during the administrations of Jefferson and Madison. He was an immigrant from Geneva who spoke with a thick accent and then moved to the backwoods of Pennsylvania before rising up the ranks of Washington politics. And his opponents considered him a foreigner, a tax rebel, and a dangerously clever man. But he represented an economic view at the beginning of American history that challenged Hamilton's vision of building up American infrastructure, largely financed by public debt. Today, I'm talking with Gregory May, who's author of the new book, Jefferson's Treasure, How Albert Gallatin Saved the New Nation from Debt. He talks about how Gallatin worked to contain the federal government by restraining its fiscal power, abolishing internal taxes in peacetime, and slashing spending. Gallatin cast a long shadow over America in the 19th century. His face was on the $500 bill issued in 1862 to 1863. Lewis and Clark named the Gallatin River after him as thanks for his help in planning their expedition. There are a number of cities in the United States named after Gallatin, and there's even a statue of him in front of the Treasury Building in Washington, D.C. So why was he forgotten? What perspective did he represent in the United States? And how does his legacy still continue to today? So we'll look at all of that and more in this discussion with Gregory May. Greg, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
You wrote a book about a person that you argue is very important in the revolutionary or post-revolutionary era, but I would imagine very few, except for big 18th century history aficionados, would know much about Albert Gallatin. So first of all, what inspired you to write about him?
Well, I wanted to write about Gallatin because he's probably the least understood of the half dozen men who really set the American government in motion. Most people know about the first four presidents, and they've probably heard something about Alexander Hamilton, especially lately. But as you say, only a few historians know much about Albert Gallatin, who really had as much to do with getting the government in operation as any of them.
Most people don't know about him, and I think the bias that a lot of us have in the modern era is if someone were important, that information would have filtered down to today, an opinion that I very much oppose, but that seems to be conventional wisdom. But why do you think it's important that people know who Gallatin was and what he did?
Well, first, perhaps a remark on the conventional wisdom. I agree it is the conventional wisdom, but usually when someone expresses that view, I ask them how many people they remember from the founding of the country. And if they can't name very many people, it seems to me that the conventional wisdom really sort of implodes, because if we don't really remember anybody except for a few presidents and generals, how can we possibly understand what was happening at that time? So I think that our short and very selective historical memories are actually completely undermining our ability to understand the American founding. Why is Gallatin important? Because he and the Jeffersonians with whom he came to power really dismantled the centralizing financial system that Hamilton had tried to put in place and established a fairly freewheeling, decentralized financial regime that lasted throughout the 19th century and had a profound effect on how the country developed economically, allowed the country in some ways to boom, but in other ways frequently to bust. And it wasn't until the early 20th century that we as a political society found that politically unacceptable and began to reconstruct the kind of European system, more centralized system, that Hamilton had had in mind, perhaps most signally with the establishment of the Federal Reserve and a complete revamp of the American tax system.
Well, I'd like to get into the weeds here and understand the world of 18th century economics and really what was going on here. And one might say, well, that sounds boring. And we would both say, well, there's a hit musical on Broadway that is about one of these people, so it can't be that boring. But so help me understand here. In the 18th century, America is a new nation. We're only a few presidents in so far. What are the main economic debates that are going on, and why are they significant?
Well, the 1790s are the critical decade because they were the first decade of the federal government. And during that 10-year period, which basically spans the time between when Washington became president and when Jefferson became president, several things happened that are critically important for the economic founding of the country. The first is that Alexander Hamilton wanted to use the opportunity created by the Constitution to consolidate economic and military power in a central government that he thought would unify the country and also make it stronger in its international relationships. We have to remember that the country at this time was just, you know, a brand new foundling on the fringe of the Atlantic, a very weak country and very vulnerable to the strong European powers of the time. So that was his vision. As he set out to do that, however, what he was doing was shifting money, actual dollars, as well as economic power into the hands of the relatively few people who held the national debt. The debt had been issued to all sorts of people during the Revolution, everyone from soldiers to farmers who provided provisions to merchants. But they had had to sell it during the 1780s when the national government basically was broke and the debt wasn't worth anything. So it ended up concentrated in the hands of a relatively few people who were going to be benefited by this Hamiltonian system. James Madison, who was the leader of the emerging opposition to this movement in Congress, and Jefferson profoundly objected to this system because they saw it as anti-democratic, and they also saw that it was shifting power and wealth from the southern colonies to the mid-Atlantic and the northern colonies. And resistance to this consolidating system actually gave rise to an armed rebellion on the frontier in western Pennsylvania. And that's how Gallatin came to national attention. He was living on the frontier. He was a young political leader who got caught up in this armed tax rebellion. And his participation, his attempt to tampen down the violence, is what brought him to national attention and got him elected to Congress, where he very quickly emerged as the leader of the Jeffersonian Republican opposition.
I'd like to hear a little bit more about his background. He is French, and I think you mentioned in your book that some people complained about his accent when he was giving speeches. I'd like to know about his background and his experiences that you think brought him to his viewpoint. Because when I think of French presence in early America, you think of cultural influential people that Lafayette, who designs a lot of Washington, D.C., or French military advisors to the war effort. But how does Gallatin fit into all this? And what do you think causes him to arrive at his perspective and his economic viewpoint?
Gallatin was born and reared in Geneva, which at the time was an independent city-state, not part of the French or the Swiss Confederation, which didn't even exist at that time.
Oh, Swiss. Yes.
He was an orphan, he emigrated to America about a year after he got out of university, really to seek his fortune. He was an orphan member of a very distinguished and well-to-do family. And I think he realized that if he was going to be anything other than a poor cousin in a great family, he needed to leave this small city-state and go seek his fortune elsewhere. So I think that's what brought him to America. And it was when he got to America that he began to appreciate the exciting opportunities created by the new Republican political system that he saw being developed in the wake of the Revolution. He had arrived a year before the victory at Yorktown, so he really saw the whole panorama unfold. And by the end of the 1780s, he was beginning to express very strong Republican ideas which were much more democratic than those of the Federalists who surrounded Washington and Hamilton and were in control of the federal government.
His plans, you painted the picture of what was happening during Hamilton's time, where it sounds like the federal debt is being concentrated in the hands of a few people and from the perspective of some could be headed towards an oligarchy, but maybe a proponent would say that, well, if you want to finance public works, you can't help but put debt in the hands of the wealthy and powerful, because how else would you fund these projects? But so what was Gallatin's plan? Why did he want to undo Hamilton's financial system and repay the national debt?
Well, Gallatin and the other Jeffersonians objected to a centralizing financial system for a number of reasons. Perhaps best summed up in an adage that Jefferson repeats in his letters trying to build political support. He talks about peace, economy, and riddance of public debt. And he saw those three things, Gallatin saw those three things, as really parts of a single puzzle. We had to have peace, because not only was peace valuable in itself, but it meant that we wouldn't have to develop a large and expensive military establishment that the government really was in no position to afford, given how indebted it already was from the Revolutionary War. Economy was essential in order, economy or frugality was essential in order to be able to control government spending and be able to commit a big chunk of the tax revenue to repayment of the debt that already was weakening the country by preventing it from building defenses and developing the country. And so riddance of public debt, from their point of view, was the key to getting rid of this huge burden that was standing in the way of the proper development of the country by the people themselves. They thought that a nation that was deeply in debt was not truly free, because it was bound by its obligations to its creditors, and it was also bound to commit too much of its resources to something that wasn't really developing the economy and wasn't really providing for the national defense.
So when he becomes the Secretary of the Treasury, what were the biggest challenges that the U.S. faced?
Well, there were two, I guess, from the point of view of the Jeffersonian Republicans. The first challenge was the debt, which they thought must be repaid for the reasons that I just explained. The second was the disruption to transatlantic trade caused by decades of war in Europe. Britain and France, the two greatest military powers in the world at the time, had been at war with each other throughout the 19th century. Indeed, to some extent, the American Revolution was just an aspect of that warfare. And by the 1790s, with the French Revolution, the two came to serious blows again that sparked war not ended until 1815. So during this 25-year period from the early 1790s through through 1815, each of those two nations was trying to prevent the other nation from trading with neutral countries and getting the kinds of provisions that it needed in order to keep its economy going and to sustain its war effort. The United States was one of the biggest neutral traders in the Atlantic at that time because we were a source of so many raw materials, foodstuffs, timber, and so on. So both countries preyed on American trade, and that was particularly troubling because most of the federal revenue came from import duties. And so disruptions to trade were not only a threat to the American economy, but also a threat to federal revenue.
And can you walk me through all the different things that Gallatin does while he's Treasury Secretary? Because he's Secretary for 12 years, which is a really long time, more than one administration. And a few of the bullet points you have listed that he does is he abolishes internal revenue taxes, slashes federal spending, and repays the debt. So can you walk me through his tenure as Treasury Secretary and what he accomplishes and the challenges he had to face to accomplish those things?
You summarized them very nicely. I guess first it's worth saying that he was Treasury Secretary under both Jefferson and Madison and for longer than anyone else has ever served in that position. So he had a profound impact on the establishment of the federal government and how it would operate for the next 100 years. He did set out, number one, to pay down the debt. And he set aside a fixed amount of money that would be used every year in priority over every other expenditure to repay the public debt. The second thing that he did was to cut taxes. Americans hated the so-called internal taxes, the excise taxes, like the one on whiskey that had sparked the rebellion in Pennsylvania. And so Gallatin and the Jeffersonian Republicans were committed to repealing those internal taxes and funding the government with import duties. In that way, they weren't unlike lots of other countries at the time. Most countries got big portions of their revenue from import duties. But few countries had dared to rely, really no other major country had dared to rely only on import duties as a source of income. But Gallatin did, because he thought that in wartime, when the government needed more money, the people would be willing to accept the reimposition of internal taxes. And finally, he tried to make it clear how much money the government was spending so that everyone would understand that and could make reasonable decisions about whether they wanted the government to be doing the things that created those expenditures. To do that, he created much clearer federal financial accounting than had ever existed before. He made clear to Congress that there were trade-offs between certain expenditures and the need to repay the debt. And this led to a rejection of many quite sensible proposals for internal improvements, roads and canals and so on, because there simply wasn't money to pay for it. And finally, he tried to make it very clear that if the federal government was to repay its debt and become strong, there would have to be continuing discipline. And that was really, perhaps in the long run, his greatest contribution to the American founding. He put in place a culture of fiscal responsibility that lasted throughout the 19th century. We did have wars, big wars in the 19th century, a war with Mexico and a civil war that were very expensive. In each case, the country ran up significant debts, but in each case, it set about a disciplined repayment of those debts after the war.
Well, there's one aspect of Jefferson's tenure I know a little bit about, and I don't know that much, so I'll have to go with this. And I bring this incident up to ask how Gallatin would fit into it and think about it. So something that Jefferson is celebrated about today by most people are the Barbary Wars, in which America really builds up its navy and stops the practice of Barbary pirates in North Africa, taking American crews, enslaving them, capturing them and enslaving them. And they were doing this after Britain had signed a treaty with the Barbary states so that British ships couldn't be captured, but American ones could. And pirates did this because they knew that America essentially had no navy, so they could enslave these crews without retaliation. So part of the Barbary Wars are the buildup of the U.S. naval fleet so that it could end this practice. So how can you explain how this fits in? Because then somebody may say, well, there was this somewhat of a military buildup in Jefferson's period. Was Gallatin able to architect it so that this buildup could be mostly financed instead of just running it on the nation's credit card? Or how did that work?
Well, in some ways, the Barbary Wars or the Tripolitan Wars, as they're often called, were just a sideshow. We had a naval war with France. It was called the Quasi-War during John Adams's administration. And we did build up the Navy to fight France. After that war died down shortly before Jefferson was elected, Congress actually passed a statute to get rid of most of the naval fleet that had been developed in order to fight the French. So by the time Jefferson came into office, the Navy was shrinking, and Jefferson continued to shrink. He was not an exponent of building a strong Navy, given the other priorities that he thought were more important, most especially the repayment of the debt. And so the Tripolitan War kept some of those ships in service for a while longer, but did not really slow down the Jeffersonian Republicans' move to control the size of the Navy. In fact, one of the biggest political fights during the administrations of Jefferson and Madison was between Gallatin and two brothers named Smith from Baltimore. One was a senator and the other secretary of the Navy, who wanted a stronger Navy. And Gallatin strongly opposed that, not because he didn't think the United States should have a significant naval power eventually, but because he thought the only Navy that we could afford at that time was going to be relatively ineffective, so the money spent on it would be a waste of money. This fight between them over our naval configuration actually came to a showdown in Madison's administration when the Smiths were pushed out of power and James Monroe took over as Secretary of State instead of one of the Smith brothers. And that really teed up his presidential possibilities. And that's why he succeeded Madison.
Okay. I had to mention that since I don't know much else about the early 19th century. But one other factor, too, is that you compare Gallatin and Hamilton a lot because they're sort of emblematic of their different ideologies. So how would you compare these two as political leaders and financial planners?
Well, they were extremely different people in almost every way. Hamilton, despite the the myth that's being created by the Broadway show, was really an insider and an elitist. He may have been denigrated by his enemies for being poor and illegitimate, but he was not really an immigrant. He was an Anglo-Saxon migrant within the British Empire, and he came here, quickly established himself as an insider during the Revolution through his relationship with George Washington, married into a very prominent and powerful New York family. And so by the time of the Constitutional Convention, he was quite elitist in his point of view and really argued for a kind of elective constitutional monarchy that would create a presidency for life and maybe life tenure for men elected to the Senate. His financial plan and his political thinking were all a piece of that. He wanted the United States to be a strong state that could be very like and compete with the great European powers. And he thought that was essential to the preservation of the country as an independent nation. Gallatin, on the other hand, was an outsider. He had come from a small city-state. He spoke French. He was discriminated against by many Americans at the time because the French, being the traditional enemies of the British, were, despite the fact that they had supported us during the Revolution, not really liked as a people, because a century of warfare and the French and Indian Wars more recently had led most British and Americans, British descent, to despise them. Gallatin became a very democratic Republican in his point of view, believing that centralizing federal power was not a good thing, since the federal government was going to be away from and not easily controlled by the people themselves. So he, like Jefferson and Madison and other leaders of the Republican Party, wanted the federal government to keep its attention on only those things that it needed to do, like foreign relations, national defense, and so on, and leave lots of the political power in the hands of the states.
Okay. And I can imagine with the press at the time, he must have been savaged in it, because the press of the early 1800s was brutal. The hatchet men used by different political parties would openly spread all these rumors that, oh, Jefferson has African ancestry, or Madison has Indian ancestry, those types of things. Was Gallatin savaged by the press as well, by his opponents at this time?
Yes, he was. He was particularly vulnerable to that kind of abuse, which, as you say, was very widespread, because he was a foreigner, a real foreigner. He spoke with a foreign, worse than that, a French accent. he was from the Pennsylvania backcountry, you know, literally the middle of nowhere. So it was easy to abuse him, and they did. In fact, well, before I say that, there are probably more political cartoons making fun of him than almost anyone else other than Jefferson, because he was so important in the Republican Party, and he was so easy to make fun of. One of them shows him standing in front of a guillotine, you know, trying to identify him and his Democratic views with the turmoil and outrages of the revolution in France. In fact, after he came to power and was Treasury Secretary, one of his political enemies complained that it was all of the Federalist abuse of Gallatin that had made him such an important political figure to begin with.
Well, it's interesting what a long shadow he casts over the 19th century, that he's on the $500 bill in the 1860s. Lewis and Clark name a river after him because he helps plan the expedition. And there's a statue of him in front of the Treasury Building in Washington. I probably have seen this before, but I ignored it because I had no idea who this person was. So he was famous, it seems like, throughout the 19th century, but almost nobody knows about him today. So why do you think that he was forgotten? Was this simply him fading into obscurity, or is it something more intentional?
Well, I think it's two things. First, to go back a bit to something we talked about earlier, we have short historical memories. We don't remember very much. And so after 200 years, you know, if we can name half a dozen people who might have been important, that's a lot. And therefore, people who weren't presidents or generals in major conflicts sort of drop off the radar. But there is a more profound reason that we have forgotten Gallatin, and that is that in the 20th century, we have built gradually a much more centralized, much more powerful, much more expensive federal government. And in order to do that, we have adopted a lot of the European ideas that Alexander Hamilton tried to implement in the 1790s. And so it's not surprising that if we look back in the past for a financial founder, the man to whom we end up pointing is Alexander Hamilton. Although it's a matter of historical fact, he originally lost, and we had a profoundly different system for most of our history.
So how do you think his story brings to life the history of the early republic? And do you think that there are any other lessons that can be drawn by his tenure as Treasury Secretary?
Well, his political accomplishments, I guess, are important today, not only because of the profound effect that they had on the country, but for a long time, but also because without understanding that profound effect and what his contributions were, it's hard for us to understand the economic history of the 19th century at all in this country. It's also difficult for us to understand how radically our current way of thinking about national finance has changed from the way in which the founders thought about it and our forefathers thought about it for most of our history. His life also, just as the life of a human being, ends up being really interesting because, like most important people at the time, he knew almost all of the other important people. So in this biography, we get really interesting personal looks at George Washington, at Jefferson and Madison, at the Marquis de Lafayette, at Madame de Staël, a very important French dissident and writer during the Napoleonic period, and John Jacob Astor, the first great American millionaire, Andrew Jackson, and many others.
All right, a lot to dig out of his story. Well, thank you for sharing all this information with us. And if people want to learn more, your book is Jefferson's Treasure, How Albert Gallatin Saved the New Nation from Debt. Greg, thank you for joining us.
Great to be here.
All right, well, that was the episode for today. Thank you so much for listening, and I hope you enjoyed it. First of all, I'd like to thank the Knowlton's Rangers, and especially our spy masters, Baron Freyza, Carl from Norway, Chris from Maine, and Melissa Sarnowski. And I'll explain what that means in a second. If you want to support the show and help me keep producing this content, there are four easy ways for you to do it. One, subscribe to the show and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. If you want to do that, you can go to historyunplugpodcast.com and there you'll find instructions. Two, join our Facebook group, which you can find if you just search for History Unplugged. And please like and share posts that I put up about new episodes. 3, submit a question to me so that I can answer it on air. You can email me at info@historyonthenet.com or leave a voicemail. And again, go to historyunplugpodcast.com and you'll find instructions. Lastly, and I think this one is the best, is to become one of the Knowlton's Rangers. The Knowlton's Rangers were an elite reconnaissance and espionage detachment of the Continental Army in the Revolutionary War, but it's also the name of the History Unplugged membership program. Learn how to join by going to patreon.com/unplugged. So here's what you get if you become one of the Knowlton's Rangers. If you join at the level of Scout, you can get early access to new podcast episodes, along with enjoying absolutely every single episode of the History Unplugged podcast ad-free. All 270 and counting episodes. If you join at the level of Intelligence Officer, you can also get access to premium episodes, like a multi-part series on the life of Audie Murphy, the most decorated combat soldier in World War II, or the 10-part series Ottoman Lives, a series that looks at the cast of characters that made up the Ottoman Empire, such as the Sultan, the Eunuch, the Harem Servant Girl, and the Soldier. And finally, if you join at the level of Spymaster, you get all the same stuff as the Scouts and Intelligence Officers, but you also get a shout-out to you and or your business at the end of each episode, a 3-pack of hardcover history books, plus you'll be put at the very front of the line for me to answer your question about history, and I can guarantee I will dedicate an episode that's about an hour long or so to your question. Sign up at patreon.com/unplugged. Again, that's patreon.com/unplugged. Anyway, those are the ways you can help out the show. Thank you so much for your support. Thanks for listening to the History Unplugged podcast. Be sure to subscribe to the show to get your daily dose of all things history related, from ancient Greece to the Cold War. We'll see you next time at the History Unplugged podcast.